I know you're rough. When you have your name, it means you're more worse than sending you up to the ERP.
Can we ask people to occupy their seats now? We'll be starting in 1 minute. So please go to your seats and then we will start. The fifth meeting of the seventh session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is now called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, distinguished observers, friends, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon we shall hold a discussion on the Pacific. At the outset, I would like to inform you of the composition of our panel. The first member of the panel is Mr. Michael Dodson, the member of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, is the expert member from the Pacific. The second panelist is His Excellency Mr. Colin Beck, permanent representative of the Solomon Islands to the United Nations. The third member will be Mr. Tom Kalma, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders Social Justice Commissioner, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, Australia. And the last panelist will be Ms. Malia Nobrega of the Pacific Indigenous Peoples Regional Caucus. So without further ado, I will start by giving the floor to my colleague, Mr. Mick Dodson, expert member of the Permanent Forum. Mick, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, and good afternoon, everyone. My greetings. The Pacific Islands are home to a diverse range of Indigenous peoples, speaking 19% of the world's estimated 5,000 languages. Indigenous peoples in the Pacific islands are still linked to their communal land, Indigenous belief systems, spirituality and custom law, which form the social, economic and political basis for peaceful coexistence. One distinctive feature of some areas of the Pacific Islands region is that Indigenous peoples make up a majority of the population. Because of the diversity of the Pacific countries and territories, there are significant variations in the social, political, and economic situations of Indigenous peoples around the region. In some countries within the Pacific region, colonial settlement and immigration has reduced the Indigenous populations to a minority in their own lands. For example, the Kanaks of Kanaki, New Caledonia, make up 44% of the population. The Kanaka Maori of Hawaii, 18%. The Maori of Aotearoa, New Zealand, 15%. The Chamorro of Guam, 14%. And the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders of Australia, 2%. And in Rapa Nui, the local Indigenous people are rapidly becoming a minority in their own community, as it's being swamped by migration from the mainland of Chile. In parts of the Pacific, the living spaces, land and waters of Indigenous peoples are targeted by industrialised nations for the dumping of toxic or radioactive waste from industrial or military operations. Often community representatives are not informed of these activities, nor of the dangers they pose. The ways in which natural resources are extracted can also devastate ecosystems and destroy Indigenous cultures and livelihoods, as shown with major mining and logging projects in countries throughout the Pacific Islands. From phosphate mining in Nauru and Banaba and Makatea Islands to copper and gold extraction at Ok-Tedi and Panguna, Freeport and Vadukoulou. There have been major environmental consequences that have devastated local ecosystems, economies and cultural practices. The starkest example of this environmental colonialism was the testing of nuclear weapons. Madam Chair, in relation to climate change, Indigenous peoples live in sensitive zones where effects of climate change are most devastating. Traditional ways of life are disproportionately affected by climate change, particularly in forest, wetlands, river and coastal areas. The Pacific Island countries are subjected to the impacts of global warming caused by excessive fossil fuel burning, atmospheric pollution and deforestation of the land hemisphere. The longer the metropolitan countries delay, the worse the impacts will become, a situation that frustrates and angers many Pacific Island leaders. The potential socio-economic impacts of climate change on the smaller island countries were estimated in a series of vulnerability studies depending on the worst-case scenarios, 1 metre sea level rise. The study suggests that sea level rise will have a negative impact on tourism, freshwater availability and quality, aquaculture, agriculture, human settlements, financial services and human health. Storm surges are likely to have a harmful impact on low-lying islands, while weather and climate patterns have been documented for many years using Western scientific techniques. Little attention has been paid to documenting the traditional environmental observations made by Indigenous peoples. Madam Chairperson, in relation to urban Indigenous peoples and migrations, migration to urban areas has grown in the Pacific over the past 30 years, not only in small island states but also in the developed countries of Australia and New Zealand. Migration from the rural to the urban is an issue in the Pacific. Urban migrants have sought out new employment opportunities and the fast money of wages and salaries rather than the slow money of cash crop sales. The most sought after jobs have been in the public service, which offered security and high wages, or in the few jobs in mining. Better urban education and medical facilities, even sport and the bright lights, have been lures for some. In a few places, land pressures discourage rural residents. In the 1960s, beginning in Polynesia, migration increasingly became international, especially for Polynesia, to the cities of New Zealand, the United States, and to a lesser extent, Australia. It followed colonial and former colonial ties. Migrants went for the same reasons they moved to town, but particularly for better jobs. Though migrants once again intended to return home after 3 decades, more Samoans, Cook Islanders, Wallaceans, and almost as many Tongans now live overseas as at home. In Samoa and Tonga especially, migration and remittances have been something of a safety valve for high population growth rates. Hence, urban problems are less severe than they are in Melanesia and Micronesia. Madam Chair, in relation to environmental refugees, in April 2008, UN Forum on Indigenous Issues, you said, Madam Chair, that there is not enough international support for Pacific Islanders who may become refugees. You said that the plight of Pacific nations is one of the most pressing issues. And to quote you, you said, where else will they go? I mean, even here in Australia, I think they are still considering whether they will accept these environmental refugees. You said it's just unthinkable. It's so inhumane that you have these people who are forced to go somewhere and you don't get countries to welcome them and support them, end quote. In respect to decolonisation, within the Pacific region, there are 5 territories to which the Declaration on Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples continue to apply. They are American Samoa, the United States of America, Guam, the United States of America, New Caledonia, France, Pitcairn, the United Kingdom, and Tokelau, New Zealand. In 1961, the General Assembly created the Special Committee on Decolonisation, which has become the focal point for the implementation of the Declaration on Decolonisation. To fulfil its mandate, the Special Committee has dispatched visiting missions to some territories for the members of the committee to see the conditions there for themselves. In its resolution adopted on 8th of December 2000, the General Assembly called upon member states to redouble their efforts to complete decolonisation. This ends my statement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd like to thank Mr. Michael Dodson, member of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, expert from the Pacific. Thank you very much, Mr. Dodson. I'd like now to call on His Excellency, Mr. Colin Beck, permanent representative of the Solomon Islands to the United Nations. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Allow me, first of all, on the outset, on congratulating you on your election. My Pacific Island colleagues are eternally grateful to all indigenous communities in the North, South, East, and West, and to the distinguished representative of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues for honoring us by having this special half-day session on the Pacific. Like all indigenous issues, we do not get much attention internationally. Within the UN setting, the Pacific is a sub-region within the Asian group. Fast-growing economies in Asia tends to cast a shining light that blinds the international system from looking at the changing landscape occurring within the Pacific. Climate change is about our survival of existence, culture, and identity. In this connection, we are pleased that the 7th Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues have climate change as its theme. Madam Chair, of the 8 million people of the Pacific, small island developing states, 80 to 90% are indigenous in all UN member states. 5 of the 12 Pacific SIDS small island developing states are classified as least developed countries, with one just recently graduated. The region is made up of Melanesian, Polynesian, and ethnic background, speaking more than 800 distinct different languages. I must hasten to add, with the exception of a few languages, all remain unwritten and cultures undocumented. My own country of 500,000, with more than 90% are indigenous, comprised largely of indigenous Melanesian, with a percentage of indigenous Polynesian population speaking 80 different languages. We also have a small Micronesian population that were relocated to Solomon Islands during the colonial period. Madam Chair, since time immemorial, our people's culture and tradition are connected to the land, the forest, mountains, river, and sea. 80% of our population, in the case of Solomon Islands, reside in the rural areas and continue to rely on the forest for their daily needs for food, to constructing houses, building canoes, to generating income. We have looked to our natural resources for revenue, leasing out fishing rights from a vast ocean, to logging our forest, given the limited economic alternatives available for the resource owners. The ecosystem are fragile and unique. Let me put this into perspective. Any increase in temperature from 1 to 2 degrees Celsius poses significant risk to the many unique and threatened biodiversity within the region. Coral in particular are vulnerable to thermal stress and have low adaptive capacity. Coral bleaching is occurring throughout the region. The world's largest saltwater lake, I must add, is in the Solomon Islands. Saltwater lagoon is in the Solomon Islands. Is also under threat. Freshwater lakes have been breached through constant cyclones. Like our other neighbors, we also are one of the 6 countries on the Coral Triangle Initiative that is commonly referred to as the Amazon of the coral reefs. Madam Chair, the Pacific region is in varying degrees are located in disaster-prone regions. Whenever disaster strikes, it accounts for half to a third of our national GDPs. Only in April last year, tsunami hit my island. 3 meters above hit my island and raised my island 3 meters above sea while it sank another neighboring island. No traditional knowledge prepared our people to explain the rising and sinking of islands. These disasters, especially cyclone, can push back development achieved decades within a couple of hours. Today, climate change has eroded our shorelines with sea level rise, and which also causes water salination. Increase of frequency of flooding, drought, earthquakes have shifted fishing grounds, uplifted reefs, disrupted agriculture. This has seen a slow movement of people from low-lying islands leaving the ancestral islands for large islands within Solomon Islands, somewhat threatening stability and peace. In other words, climate change has been responsible for urban drift and is creating new pockets of poverty, placing stress on an economy that is narrowly agricultural-based with a large public sector. For the indigenous, it is also a clash of two worlds between tradition and modern. There is also a growing cost of food and dependency on imported food, resulting in new and non-communicable diseases, is now reality. Secondly, malaria is, in the case of Solomon Islands, is our number one killer. Over-commercialization of the environment has disrupted many of our environment, fragile environments. Besides that, the potential of conflict, given the various land tenure system, is real. The issue is what can be done on climate change. As I've said before, that climate change is an old problem that needs new solution. And let us touch on some solutions. First, climate change, in our view, is multifaceted and it needs a UN system-wide approach, not just from a development perspective. It is a security issue in all its aspects, human security, food security. It is also a rights issue and nation-building issue. If unaddressed, these issues will fester and grow and explode in time. The United Nations must also, in our view, move from policy to delivering on-the-ground activities. UN country presence is essential. The usual blaming on policies and governance has gone from Solomon Islands' perspective for too long, and that's come at an expense of our national policies. We have become so flexible and open in accessing funds with partners, and this, again, has been done at the expense of our national policies. We need a stronger UN presence in all Pacific countries. Second, the international community must also move away from placing too much emphasis on market solutions. There is a reluctance of private sector to invest in rural areas. Public investment is needed, but that can be done through the lens of communities rather than the market, allowing rural communities to take advantage of economic opportunities. In the Solomon Islands, has, in this respect, have created a ministry focused on assisting indigenous population to participate in the economy. This is because of the fact that our economy is now foreign-owned and the general population are now spectators to the economic activities. Third, there are other areas in which could be done, and one of them is clean energy. Clean energy. For us, clean energy provides a way forward. For many Pacific seeds, energy accounts for a third of our national budget. Getting adequate technology is a must to free up domestic resources to address all MDGs. Again, in the case of Solomon Islands, access to energy only accounts for just 20% of the population. Fourth, valuing our virgin forests for carbon credit purposes is a means of halting unsustainable harvesting of forest. But more importantly, it provides an income to the resources owners. Fifth, we believe that there is sufficient technology available, but it has not been transferred and resources have been difficult to access. Strong leadership, especially from the Annex I countries or the industrialized countries, in coordinating a more simplified manner, in a more simplified mechanism that can be assessed and accommodate requests, especially small requests from small island developing states. Currently, we feel that there are on the Bali process. Currently, we feel that there are too many processes coming out from Bali. Everyone is doing something on climate change, but in our views, no one is doing anything to make a real difference. A global architect needs to be developed to facilitate smooth coordination in addressing climate change challenges. Many partners have had their own adaptation and mitigation process outside of the multilateral one. There needs to be a sense of what needs to be done immediately in the medium, long and long-term future, both on food security and early warning system. Also at international level, we feel that the 1994 Barbados Program of Action, which outlined the special needs of small island developing states, including climate change and the Mauritius strategy, needs to be implemented. Finally, the time for action is now. We in the present need to look to the past to create a better future for our generation of tomorrow, to live in freedom from want, freedom from fear, and freedom to live in dignity. My Pacific colleague once again would like to thank you for chairing this event, Madam Chair. It would be remiss of me not to acknowledge our bigger neighbor, Australia, for the swift action taken by the government both on climate change in ratifying the Kyoto Protocol and on the indigenous issue in relation to the apologies to the stolen generation, as alluded to in the opening statement. We salute and thank the government and people of Australia and New Zealand for their continuous support to the Pacific. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, His Excellency Ambassador Colin Beck, the permanent representative of the Solomon Islands to the United Nations. Thank you very much for making us aware about these issues that indigenous peoples face in the small island states. I would like to call now on Mr. Tom Kalma, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, Australia. Mr. Kalma, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I speak as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner and National Race Discrimination Commissioner of Australia. I am a member of the Australia's National Human Rights Institution. Our Commission plays an active role in technical assistance programs within our region, and currently our President chairs the Asia-Pacific Forum of National Human Rights Institutions. The Asia-Pacific Forum is a regional body of national institutions that have been accredited as complying with the Paris Principles of the General Assembly on the functioning of independent national human rights commissions. Madam Chair, there has been extremely limited focus by governments in development programs and by the United Nations on building the mechanisms for the protection of human rights in the Pacific region. This has a particularly severe impact on Indigenous peoples within the Pacific, as well as on women. Among Pacific Island states, there is a limited ratification of human rights treaties and a significant protection gap between international standards and domestic legal systems. There are also limited institutional mechanisms, such as national human rights institutions and United Nations field presence, to further human rights. At present, for example, other than Australia and New Zealand, there are no existing national human rights commissions at the domestic level that meet the requirements laid out in the Paris Principles for independent, robust national institutions. It means that the Pacific region has fallen behind every other region in the world in terms of the existence of human rights mechanisms. I recommend to the Permanent Forum that it advise ECOSOC of the urgent need for technical assistance and development cooperation in the Pacific region to build the capacity of Pacific Island nations to implement human rights standards and develop local institutions to promote human rights. This should be accompanied by efforts to promote increased ratification of human rights treaties within the region and their domestic implementation. I further recommend that the Permanent Forum request a special rapporteur on Indigenous issues to focus his attention on the Pacific region, including through visits to address this situation, and that states be encouraged to contribute funding to the various voluntary funds to increase participation of Indigenous peoples from the Pacific Island nations in the Permanent Forum, as well as other human rights mechanisms. Madam Chair, it is vital that I also mention the importance of advancing the decolonisation agenda within the Pacific region. there remains a number of territories to whom the Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples still applies. Progress is slow and attention is required. I therefore further recommend that the Permanent Forum request ECOSOC to reiterate to the General Assembly the importance of states completing the decolonisation process within the Pacific region with immediacy, and note the need for special assistance by the United Nations to assist fledgling democracies within the Pacific region. The Pacific Island nations are also vulnerable to climate change impacts such as of becoming disappearing nations. The preservation of cultural identity, landlessness and situations of being climate change refugees are all major challenges that could arise in the Pacific region in the coming decades. The Permanent Forum should also recommend that the High Commission for Refugees ensure a specific focus on refugee issues in the Pacific region, given the particular vulnerabilities of Indigenous peoples in this region. Madam Chair, we have also and already heard about some of the efforts that the new Australian government has taken to re-engage with Indigenous communities and to enter into new partnerships. On the first day of the sitting of the new Parliament, a welcome to country was provided by the local Indigenous tribe for the first time in the history of the Australian Parliament. And this will occur each year at the opening of Parliament, and that's welcomed. On the first day of business of the new Parliament, the first item of business was to apologise to the Stolen Generations for past policies of forcible removal of Aboriginal children from their families. And on the 20th of March 2008, the Prime Minister and National Indigenous Health Representative bodies committed to a new relationship with the express purpose of eliminating the 70-year life expectancy gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians by the year 2030. And these bodies also committed to halving Indigenous infant mortality rates within 10 years, consistent with the Millennium Development Goals. The Prime Minister signed a statement of intent to close the gap on Indigenous health, and this was a result of a two-year campaign led by my office, where every major Indigenous and non-Indigenous organisation from the health, human rights, reconciliation and NGO sectors have worked together to achieve a reform agenda for Indigenous health. And the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Health has commented that this campaign constitutes world best practice for implementing the right to health for Indigenous peoples. Through this, the government has committed to a partnership approach with Indigenous peoples to close the gap, namely to establish a long-term plan funded to the level of need based on benchmarks and targets that are matched to the progressive realisation principle and addressing the key criteria of the rights to health. The government has also announced a number of mechanisms to embed these commitments into the day-to-day operations of the government. A National Indigenous Health Equality Council is soon to be established to guide the process, and the Prime Minister will report to Parliament on progress on the first day of Parliament each year. Madam Chair, each of these developments is a major advance for Indigenous peoples in Australia. They also reflect a partnership approach based on shared ambitions and shared goals. Despite this, however, there still remain significant human rights challenges within Australia. Most notably is the continued absence of a formal process for engagement with and the effective participation of Indigenous peoples in policy-making processes, something that the government has committed to rectify. And there is what has become known as the Northern Territory Intervention. Madam Chair, in July last year, the government announced an emergency intervention to address violence and abuse in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory, a province of Australia. Measures to tackle violence are to be welcomed. The intervention, however, involves a sweeping range of measures that impinge upon Indigenous people's rights in significant ways. For example, programs that provided community development opportunities in Indigenous communities were abolished and Indigenous peoples were moved on to social security payments. Indigenous peoples in receipt of such payments were then subjected to mandatory quarantining of their money. Regardless of circumstances, 50% of their social security entitlements is quarantined and can only be used at specified stores using store credit cards to purchase essential items such as food. A decision can also be made for the quarantining to be increased to 100% of their welfare entitlement, and these arrangements have only been applied to Indigenous peoples. Measures were also introduced to enable Aboriginal townships to be compulsorily acquired without access to the normal schemes for compensation and without consent. And finally, administrative and procedural safeguards, such as administrative reuse of decisions by bureaucrats, was also limited or removed. Most worryingly, all the measures introduced have been made exempt from the protections of the racial discrimination legislation. So in the exercise of any powers under the legislation for the Northern Territory, there is no requirement for programs to be racially non-discriminatory. In my role as the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, I report to the Federal Parliament each year on human rights issues facing Indigenous Australians. I have recommended how the Federal Parliament can amend the legislation to make it non-discriminatory. The new government has stated that they will consider the findings of this report as part of reviewing the Northern Territory arrangements after 12 months of operation. That is in August this year. I welcome this commitment from them and will advise this forum of progress at the next session. The continuation of discriminatory arrangements in the meantime, however, is contrary to the partnership approach which the new government has sought to establish with Indigenous communities, and it is entirely inconsistent with Australia's international treaty obligations under ICERD, CROC, CEDAW and ICCPR. This is a matter that will continue to be closely watched by the Human Rights Treaty Committees and Special Rapporteurs for the of the Human Rights Council. It is also a matter of significant concern for other agencies such as UNICEF, UNIFEM, UNHCHR and UNITAR. Put simply, no UN agency would ever fund a development package of this nature in the Pacific that was based on systemic racial discrimination against Indigenous peoples. No Australian government would fund an overseas development package that was built on such an approach either. And yet this is what is happening within Australia in the Northern Territory at the moment. Programs to address family violence and child abuse in Indigenous communities must be built on respect for human rights, and frankly, it is a nonsense to suggest that a non-discriminatory approach cannot be found. I conclude by further recommending that the Permanent Forum call upon all states to address situations of violence and abuse within Indigenous communities, and to do so on a non-discriminatory basis and consistent with human rights standards and with full and effective participation of Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tom Palmer. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission from Australia. I'd like now to call on Malia Nubriga, who is going to speak on behalf of the Pacific Regional Caucus. Malia Nubriga, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a statement on behalf of the Pacific Caucus gathered here at the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and we thank the Permanent Forum for allowing us the opportunity for having this dialogue in this, the seventh session of the Permanent Forum. Madam Chair, the Pacific region is an Indigenous region. We have many states in the Pacific, all of whom have Indigenous peoples. Yet many of our Indigenous peoples are not recognized nor respected and are denied their most basic human rights. Political, nuclear, military, economic, and environmental violations of our Pacific people's Indigenous rights by superpowers, as well as by our own governments and transnational corporations, are mounting. Distressing struggles of our Pacific Island colonized peoples for freedom, our cultural identities, sacred environments, and natural resources remain unresolved. The end of nuclear testing in the Pacific does not mean that this is the end of the nuclear age. Pacific Indigenous peoples continue to call for an end to the transshipment, storage, and dumping of nuclear waste in the Pacific, the cleanup and ongoing monitoring of contaminated sites and support for test site workers affected by nuclear testing, especially in Te Ao Mauhi, French Polynesia, Christmas Island, and the Marshall Islands. Madam Chair, our air, our land, and our waters are sacred. We are not the dump site of the world. Madam Chair, yesterday, the Pacific Caucus presented our intervention on climate change and pointed out that we see and live the negative effects on our terrestrial and marine resources, which are the fundamental basis of our daily lives. For us, it is a matter of life and death. In many cases, our Pacific Indigenous peoples are forced to leave our ancestral lands and territories and live in foreign lands that we do not identify with. We plead accountability against those causing these violations of our rights to exist as peoples, as countries, and as sovereign nations. Indigenous peoples hold many of the solutions to heal our mother, the Earth, from her rape by colonialism, which is now causing climate change. But many rogue mining companies and other extractive industries operate with impunity and impact our nations and peoples at the very core of our being and at the very essence of our existence through the desecration of our sacred sites and our sacred waters. Our people become weakened through the assault on our spirituality, leading to depression, division, oppression, and even death. Yet at this time of climate change, Indigenous peoples need to be strong and influential in caring for our earth and each other. Madam Chair, agriculture in the Pacific region, especially in our small island states, is becoming increasingly vulnerable due to heat stress on plants and saltwater incursions. Hence, food security is of great concern to our region. The Pacific is concerned with hazardous waste being imported and used in our communities, and the major hazard it is to our public health. All of our biodiversity, including our endemic species, our fresh water, and marine environments. In particular, persistent organic pollutants are a significant problem, and these include pesticides, general industrial chemicals, medical waste, laboratory chemicals, oil, and timber treatment chemicals and fertilizers. Chemical companies selling pesticides and weed killers present a health threat to our peoples by polluting groundwater and contaminating our fragile environments. Madam Chair, over the last two decades, members of our Pacific Caucus have tirelessly worked with other Indigenous peoples to intervene and advocate for the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Its recent adoption in September of 2007 is a great achievement. However, its true and lasting value will depend on our collective ability to translate it into substantive and sustainable action, and we are ready and willing to work with the Permanent Forum on its plan for implementation. More importantly, it is in the effective vindication and prompt implementation of our rights to our lands, territories, waters, and resources. Madam Chair, migration and immigration have also become issues for the Pacific. For example, the people of Papua New Guinea's Bougainville Atoll Island of Carteret have asked to be moved to higher ground on the mainland. The people of Sikayana Atoll in the Solomon Islands have been migrating primarily to Honiara, the capital. There has been internal migration from the outer islands of Tuvalu to the capital, Funafuti. Our ecosystems are very fragile, and it cannot sustain the augmentation of our population by means of uncontrolled migration and immigration. We are feeling the negative environmental consequences including the increased demand on local resources. Madam Chair, it has also been brought to our attention that Indigenous peoples are being blocked from these very meetings and have asked to raise this concern globally. Our Indigenous brothers and sisters from Taiwan have faced many obstacles in attending meetings due to political reasons. Indigenous peoples should not be kept out of UN meetings like the Permanent Forum and view this as a violation to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Madam Chair, it is a problem that the Asia region and Pacific region does not have an authoritative intergovernmental organization like all other regions of the world, which might establish a regional charter and a regional commission on human rights, and therefore would also lead to a regional court of justice for Indigenous peoples. Finally, we recognize much of the human rights deprivations in the Pacific, loss of cultural integrity, inability to protect our ancestors' remains, alienation from traditional lands, as inextricably linked to our international personalities as non-self-governing territories, both presently and formally listed. The human rights situation in these territories is apparent and serves as the most powerful challenge to UN legitimacy. Decade after decade, the UN engages in colonial accommodation, as it is well known that the Special Committee on Decolonization remains at best lamentably ineffective and at worst an active participant in the systemic denial of the Indigenous peoples of the non-self-governing territories to the most basic human right of self-determination. We respectfully call on the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to take the lead on this issue and sponsor an expert seminar in conjunction with the CERD on the situation of the Indigenous peoples of the non-self-governing territories. We will be presenting a global statement with the support not only of the Indigenous peoples of the Pacific, but also the Indigenous peoples of Puerto Rico and the Caribbean community states. Some of our other recommendations include that the forum utilize the interagency support group to begin to implement the program of implementation with UN agencies like UNDP, UNEP, and other agencies and specialized bodies as directed by the General Assembly. We also recommend that the forum communicate its concern for the human rights of Indigenous peoples and all peoples in the non-self-governing territories to the UN Human Rights Council and request that the Council designate a special rapporteur on the situation of the peoples of the non-self-governing territories. We also recommend that the Permanent Forum concern that regional presidents, representation, and services in the Asia-Pacific region are mostly limited to the Asia sub-region alone, and recommend that all UN agencies review their operations to provide equal services to the Pacific sub-region, and that they identify their operations separately according to the two sub-regions of Asia and Pacific, and that the forum actively participate in the forthcoming processes under the UNFCCC and other related processes in order to raise issues critical to Indigenous peoples in these fora, and that the forum undertake in conjunction with the Human Rights Council mechanism and the interagency support group an effort to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We also request that a joint report before the 8th Permanent Forum from the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General on Business and Human Rights and the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples identifying transnationals and their types of behavior which breach the inherent rights detailed in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. and our final recommendations that the Pacific Forum, the Regional Assembly of Governments of the Pacific Region, endorse the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and implement a plan for the promotion and protection of the rights in that declaration. Finally, sorry, I have one more, and that the Pacific Forum develop a robust structure for the contribution from and participation of Indigenous peoples' representatives in the Pacific Forum meetings and related structures and activities. And in conclusion, I would like to invite the students from the University of Hawaii, as well as our professors who have brought a little ho'okupu, a little gift for those of our members, our permanent forum members. And this is a lei, a garland made out of kukui, which stands for enlightenment. And they will be presenting this in the closure of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Malia. I'd like now to call on the Hawaii. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thank you very much to our panelists for giving all those introductory statements. I will now turn to the list of speakers, and I'll start with the state members of the United Nations represented by observers. I'd like to call on Mr. Greg Roche, Assistant Secretary, Australian Department of Families, Housing, Community Services, and Indigenous Affairs. You have the floor, Mr. Roche.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bearing in mind the special theme of this forum, Australia would like to speak today on the issue of climate change in the Pacific region. Before doing so, may I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this important meeting is being held. Our climate is changing. Countries are experiencing noticeable transformations in the weather. Temperatures are increasing, seasons are changing, weather patterns at times are unpredictable. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has projected a global average sea level rise of between 19 and 58 centimetres by 2100. Air temperature in the South Pacific is estimated to be at least 2.5 degrees Celsius above 1990 levels. Since 2006, Australia has channeled a substantial amount of funding through the Global Environment Facility, the GEF, which allocates over 30% of its funds to its climate change focal area. Our commitment, of $59.8 million Australian to the fourth replenishment from 2006 to 2010 brings our total contribution to the GEF to $240 million Australian since its inception in 1991. The IPCC has highlighted that developing countries, particularly the low-lying islands of the Pacific, are especially vulnerable to the effects of climate change, sea level rise, and extreme events. Impacts include deterioration of coastal conditions, increased inundation and storm surge, and increased water stress. Pacific Island Forum members, including Australia, have endorsed the Pacific Islands Framework for Action on Climate Change for 2006 to 2015, which identifies adaptation as a key priority. Through the Pacific Regional Environmental Program, the SPREP, forum members have prepared a plan that identifies national and regional actions to implement this framework. The Australian Government is committed to helping our Pacific neighbours tackle climate change issues. We will do this by increasing Australia's aid expenditure on the climate change adaptation by $150 million Australian over the next 3 years, giving particular attention to the needs of our neighbours in the Pacific and East Timor, and by sharing Australia's scientific and technical expertise in monitoring climate change and modelling impacts. New measures will build upon existing practical support to Pacific Island countries to address climate change, including the long-running South Pacific Sea Level and Climate Monitoring Project, assistance to build the capacity of national meteorological services to provide weather and climate prediction support to stakeholders, practical assistance to build resilience to climate change by increasing water storage capacity, diversifying crops and replanting mangroves, and assistance for adaptation planning and implementation through the United Nations Least Developed Countries Fund. The Australian Government has invested more than $50 million Australian in these initiatives. At the UN climate change negotiations in Bali, it was agreed for the first time that action on deforestation must be part of a future response to climate change. Australia is taking practical action on deforestation through collaborative efforts with the Papua New Guinea and Indonesian governments, including the Papua New Guinea-Australia Forest Carbon Partnership, which was announced by Prime Ministers Rudd and Somare on 6 March 2008. Under the partnership, Australia will support Papua New Guinea's efforts to reduce emissions from deforestation and seek to include deforestation emissions in the next international climate change agreement. Australia has worked closely with the World Bank on the development of the bank's Forest Carbon Partnership Facility, the FCPF. The Australian Government reaffirmed a $10 million US commitment to the FCPF at its launch in Bali in December 2007. This was the first contribution to the partnership. The Asia-Pacific Forestry Skills and Capacity Building Program is designed to assist countries in the Asia-Pacific region to increase their forest management expertise and improve the carbon sequestration performance of their forests. The Australian Government is also dealing with climate change closer to home. For residents of the Torres Strait, the impact of sea level rise in combination with extreme weather events leading to inundation and island erosion is of significant concern. The recent fourth assessment report by the International Panel on Climate Change highlighted that as a consequence of king tides in 2005 and 2006, there is a, and I quote, need to revisit short-term coastal protection and long-term relocation plans for up to 2,000 Australians living on the central coral cays and northwest islands, unquote, of the Torres Strait. The Australian Government and the Torres Strait Regional Authority have recognised the need for better information on the extent and causes of coastal erosion, inundation and climate change impacts in the Torres Strait so that the most appropriate policy responses and support can be developed. A number of research projects and adaptive planning arrangements are underway to address this. As an example, James Cook University researchers are conducting a study on coastal erosion impacts for several Kay Islands in the Torres Strait. The project focuses on community participation in active research to promote understanding of island erosion processes amongst local island communities. The project also provides an excellent opportunity for local communities to participate in planning for adaptation to environmental change. A project by the Marine and Tropical Research Facility, Climate Change Impacts on the Torres Strait, Building Resilience and Planning Adaptation Strategies, will establish the needs and priorities of each area in the region and provide direction for a coordinated strategic approach to climate change responses. The primary goal of this project is to find ways to increase the ability of local communities to deal with environmental change by integrating scientific and traditional knowledge. The Torres Strait Regional Authority, together with the Environmental Protection Authority, has formed a Torres Strait Coastal Management Committee, which will lead a coordinated approach to coastal management and climate change. Members of the forum, as you are no doubt aware, the impact of climate change will fall disproportionately upon developing countries and the most vulnerable persons within all countries, those who can least afford to adapt to a changing climate. Australia is committed to assisting our neighbours in the Pacific region and our own communities in the Torres Strait to ensure they are equipped to deal with climate change. This is happening through substantial funding for research and adaptive planning projects, partnerships to protect and expand forests, sharing of climate data and technology, as well as policy lessons and experiences, and the building of regional and international coalitions to add momentum to global efforts to deal with climate change. Adapting to climate change impacts is a complex task. We are at an early stage in understanding the likely impacts and options for dealing with them. What we do know is that local communities, including Indigenous people, must play a central role in the planning and implementation of responses to climate change if these are to have any chance of succeeding in the long term. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Greg Roche, Assistant Secretary, Australian Department of Families, Housing, Community Services and Indigenous Affairs. Thank you, sir. I'd like to call now on Ms. Kirsty Graham, Deputy Permanent Representative of New Zealand to the United Nations. You have the floor, madam.
Ena mana, ena iwi, ena reo. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you, Madam Chair. New Zealand welcomes this opportunity to participate in the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and to contribute in this timely discussion on the Pacific. As a founding member of the Pacific Islands Forum, New Zealand has very close relations with the Pacific Islands based on shared historical, cultural and trade links, and extensive people-to-people networks with significant Pacific communities living in New Zealand. We also have constitutional obligations for the Cook Islands, Niue and Tokelau. Working in partnership with Pacific Island countries, New Zealand supports the development of a stable and prosperous Pacific region that advances the well-being and rights of all of its peoples. Our key development goal is reduced poverty, assisting the Pacific Islands to meet all of the Millennium Development Goals will contribute to this. The Pacific Island region has many development challenges, notably in Melanesia. After sub-Saharan Africa, it is the least likely region to meet the MDGs. For example, only half of primary school children have access to formal schooling in the Solomon Islands. And 20% of the population in Vanuatu have no access to healthcare services. Security crises and political and ethnic conflicts have in many situations compounded these challenges. New Zealand has played an active role in assisting Pacific Islands to respond to the challenges they face, including through support for political processes, peace support operations, and development assistance. We are increasing our bilateral engagement and devoting significant effort to improving regional mechanisms. Almost half of New Zealand's aid budget is allocated to the Pacific Islands region. New Zealand's aid program focuses on strengthening Pacific governance, encouraging broader-based economic growth and improved livelihoods, improved health and education outcomes, and reducing vulnerabilities, including the impact of climate change. Promoting human rights and gender equality in the region are recognised as essential cross-cutting issues that must be addressed to achieve these outcomes. The Pacific Islands are extremely vulnerable to climate change and its effects. As a result, we actively support the South Pacific Regional Environment Program, SPREP, the development of the Pacific Framework and Action Plan on Climate Change, and community-level projects on adaptation to climate change. At the global level, New Zealand is helping advance Pacific interests by actively supporting strong international action and the need for a new comprehensive negotiation under the UNFCCC involving participation by both developed and developing countries. As part of our engagement with Pacific Islands, New Zealand has a long-standing tradition of support for local and Indigenous solutions to political and development issues. New Zealand has drawn on its own domestic experience and supported Indigenous initiatives for many years. This has included customary land use and management, such as the establishment of the Customary Land Tribunal in Vanuatu in 2000. Another example is the early childhood education system in the Solomon Islands, which has, through New Zealand assistance, been modelled on pioneering work by Maori women in New Zealand. New Zealand encourages the continuing and increased attention from the whole United Nations system on the Pacific Island region, and we are grateful for the opportunity for discussion of this unique region here in the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kirsty Graham, Deputy Permanent Representative of the New Zealand to the United Nations. I'd like to call now on Ms. Tricia Rady, Manager, Program Director, Program in Peacekeeping and Preventive Diplomacy of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research. You have the floor, Madam.
National training program to enhance the conflict prevention and peace-building capacities of Indigenous peoples' representatives of the Pacific provided advanced training in conflict analysis, negotiation, and resolution to Indigenous representatives from Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia. The program has been designed to respond to the urgent need and request for this kind of ongoing training program at the regional level, and to develop the capacity of Indigenous peoples working on these issues to build constructive, lasting working relationships with governments and other stakeholders, with regional organizations, and the United Nations. Senior Indigenous representatives and resource persons from the Pacific had indicated that the Pacific is one of the most marginalized regions in the world, and that Indigenous peoples in the Pacific, for geographical reasons and due to resource constraints, were among the most neglected. They accordingly requested UNITAR make this training program available in the Pacific region so that their colleagues coming from throughout this vast area could build their capacities to resolve conflict in a constructive and sustainable manner. 31 Indigenous representatives, including 17 women, composing 55% of participants from throughout the Pacific region, participated in the training program. Participants included human rights advocates, representatives of Indigenous governance structures, managers of peace-building and reconciliation projects, an advisor to the Parliamentary Select Committee of the Autonomous Government of Bougainville, heads of national and regional women's organizations, managers of peace, disarmament, and decolonization programs of a Pacific Regional Center, coordinators of development, land, and environmental rights organizations, heads of national and regional NGO networks, health advisors, environmental advocates, and others working to improve the quality of life for their communities and peoples. The training program took place in August 2007 in Canberra, Australia. Funding for the program was provided by the Royal Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Denmark, the Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Finland, the Royal Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Norway, the Ministry for Foreign Affairs of Sweden, and the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation. UNITAR is very grateful for this support, which made this first requested regional training program for the Pacific region possible. We also appreciate the work of the Australian Indigenous Leadership Center, which organized the local and regional arrangements for the training. In order to ensure the relevance of the training to the needs of those participating, the program was designed with Indigenous leaders from the region to address issues and priorities of importance to Indigenous peoples, with a particular emphasis on some of the key issues faced in the Pacific. Sessions and case studies were held, for example, on identity issues and conflict, on establishing the groundwork for cooperation and partnership, negotiating with governments and the private sector, and negotiating with extractive industries. The majority of resource persons for the program were Indigenous experts from Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia. These included a former government minister from Vanuatu, a senior lecturer on Maori business at the Victoria University of Wellington from New Zealand, and we were very pleased to have rapporteur and member of the UN Permanent Forum from the Pacific, Professor Mick Dodson, serve as a resource person for the regional training. We also appreciate the reports provided by Mr. Tom Kalma, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner of Australia, which were included in the handbook of materials provided to each participant in the regional training. Other speakers included the incoming UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples, Professor Jim Anaya, and an African academic leader and conflict resolution practitioner. Two very senior Indigenous participants from Bougainville were invited to present on their peacebuilding and governance work. Participants found the program very relevant and directly applicable to their work and urged UNITAR to continue to make this capacity-building program available to Indigenous leaders, both internationally for those participating in UN and international processes and structures, and regionally for those representatives working at local, national, and regional levels for the peaceful resolution of conflict. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Trisha Raby from UNITAR. I'd like to call now on Douglas Nakashima of the UNESCO Chief Sciences for Society Section, Division of Science Policy and Sustainable Development. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, UNESCO appreciates having this opportunity to make this intervention with respect to its work with Indigenous peoples in the Pacific. As we spoke earlier on climate change, we would like to focus this intervention on the additional designated theme of development, in particular follow-up to the Mauritius Strategy for Small Island Developing States and the Millennium Development Goal 2 to achieve universal primary education and MDG 7 to ensure environmental sustainability. Of course, the achievement of education targets, especially for Indigenous peoples, must take into consideration important factors in line with UNESCO's promotion of quality education. That is to say, education that takes into account the importance of mother tongue, as well as the need for locally relevant content such as Indigenous knowledge. Furthermore, in the Pacific context, UNESCO also recognized the necessity to take into account Indigenous knowledge and customary management practices alongside science when ensuring environmental sustainability. To this end, UNESCO's Local Indigenous Knowledge Systems Program, along with UNESCO's Pacific Office in Apia, Samoa, has placed considerable emphasis on documenting Indigenous knowledge and producing materials that may serve a dual purpose, that of promoting recognition of Indigenous knowledge as a basis for natural resource co-management, and serving as pedagogical tools that ensure the presence of Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous languages in the classroom. One example of this effort from the Pacific region is the publication on Reef and Rainforest, Environmental Encyclopedia of Marova Lagoon, Solomon Islands. This reference tool was developed upon the request of the Marova peoples and in collaboration with the University of Bergen, Norway. It includes over 1,200 terms with definitions in the Marova language relating to significant plants, animals, and features of the coral reef, lagoon, and tropical rainforest environments of Solomon Islands in Melanesia. The encyclopedia provides recognition to Indigenous knowledge and as an essential management tool and a first basis for dialogue between state resource managers and the customary land and sea-owning clans of Marova Lagoon. In addition, The Morovo Encyclopedia has been piloted in several primary and secondary schools as one of the first pedagogical tools available in the Morovo language. It also includes indexes to two other Melanesian languages, Huava and Vanunu, in order to expand its linguistic impact. The pilot exercise was a considerable success, with many students using their mother tongue in the classroom for the first time. Teacher manuals are now being developed to support the regular use of the Morovo Encyclopedia in the classroom, and plans are being made to experiment with an internet-based version, taking advantage of the expanding internet network that is currently connecting rural schools in many parts of the Solomons. A second initiative that combines indigenous knowledge with new information and communication technologies is the interactive multimedia CD-ROM entitled The Canoe is the People, Indigenous Navigation in the Pacific. This CD-ROM celebrates Pacific Islander knowledge of navigation and the ocean environment. It targets indigenous youth with the goal of reinforcing pride in the knowledge and practices of Pacific cultures and strengthening ties between elders and youth. It includes original video footage of prominent master navigators and canoe builders across the Pacific, such as Mao Piolik from Satawal in the Federated States of Micronesia, Sir Tom Davis from the Cook Islands, Heck Busby from Aotearoa, New Zealand, amongst others. It also includes animations that demonstrate the sophisticated knowledge that Pacific navigators use to locate small, isolated patches of land in a vast ocean using star compasses, stick charts, swell patterns, bird and sea life. A complete Maori language version of this interactive CD-ROM learning tool has recently been developed in collaboration with Waikato University, New Zealand. We hope that Pacific language versions may be developed if resources can be identified, that is, additional Pacific language versions. UNESCO is currently working with curriculum experts from Tonga and New Zealand, notably Auckland University, to finalize a learner's resource pack that may facilitate the uptake of the CD in Pacific curricula in order to achieve the overall goal of strengthening Indigenous knowledge content in formal schooling. A final draft of the learner's resource pack, including a teacher's manual and a learner's handbook, will be soon presented at a meeting of Pacific Directors of Education that will take place in Fiji in May. To conclude, I would like to repeat my invitation to interested Indigenous communities and their organizations, as well as other groups, to participate in the internet-based forum entitled On the Front Lines of Climate Change that will be launched in the coming weeks. This forum, a joint effort of UNESCO with the Secretary of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity, and the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, is of particular significance to small island developing states due to their particular vulnerability to climate change impacts, including sea level rise and extreme climatic events. We welcome Indigenous and other vulnerable communities to exchange their observations and interpretations of climate change impacts and adaptation. It is hoped that the forum will help expand recognition in global climate change debates of the important role to be played by Indigenous observations and coping strategies. To sign up, please send an email to links@unesco.org. Copies of the UNESCO materials mentioned above will be made available at the back of the room. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Douglas Nakashima from the UNESCO. I'd like now to call on Celeste McKay, the Indigenous Peoples Caucus North America Region. You have the floor.
Madam Chair, first I'd like to thank the Indigenous Peoples of this territory for welcoming us here today. This statement is an excerpt of the written report submitted by the North America Region Preparatory Meeting for the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues 7th Session, held February 22nd to 23rd, 2008, on Coast Salish territory in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. This was attended by 49 representatives from 38 Indigenous nations and organizations from North America. The report in its entirety is available as conference room paper 4 in the official documents for this session. Addressing agenda item 6, half-day discussion on the Pacific, the participants in this meeting from the North American region respectfully express the following to this session. The participants noted with concern the extreme effects of climate change and global warming on Indigenous peoples in the Pacific. They noted the effects of rising ocean levels, which are creating sinking states, such as Tuvalu, are also impacting Indigenous peoples in the United States and Canada, particularly in the northernmost regions. This creates situations of forced relocation for island and seacoast peoples. The participants urge the permanent forum to address these concerns with utmost urgency and to recommend that the new expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples give high priority to the study of this issue in conjunction with Indigenous peoples. This includes carrying out the recommendations made by the 24th session of the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, which include encouraging states to complete the questionnaire on the legal implications of disappearance of states and other territories for environmental reasons, including the implications for the human rights of their residents, with particular reference to the rights of Indigenous peoples, and providing an assessment of the results and recommended next steps to the Human Rights Council, the Permanent Forum, and other relevant UN bodies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Celeste McKay, Indigenous Peoples Caucus North America. I'd like to call now on Lilikala Kamehelehiwa from the Global Indigenous Women's Caucus. You have the floor, Madam.
Chairwoman, members of the UN Permanent Forum, my sisters and brothers here today, aloha. We as Indigenous women throughout the world focus this statement on Indigenous women of the Pacific and our current challenges related to traditional knowledge and health, healing, and climate change. For us, the earth is female, and the destruction of the land and the oceans of the Pacific is a terrible wrong for us. For example, in Hawaii, the greatest threat to the Earth Mother, and indeed to the health of the Kanaka Maoli, the Indigenous peoples of Hawaii, is the United States military, which occupies vast tracts of land in the Hawaiian archipelago. The island of Oahu, where the capital of Honolulu is located, is where the U.S. military insists on practicing live fire bombing to prepare for the war in Iraq. These activities occur in the western part of the island, where the largest population of Indigenous Hawaiians live. Yet there is no terrain in tropical Hawaii that is like any place in Iraq. We recently learned that the U.S. military will bring thousands more troops to Oahu as it downsizes the 20,000 Marines and U.S. bases in Okinawa. Worse yet, this last week it was announced in the Honolulu newspapers that they have decided to base the Stryker Tank Brigade on Oahu, which will require another 1,400 acres of land used only for war games trials on Oahu, an island only 44 miles wide and 30 miles long. Finally, the entire U.S. Pacific nuclear submarine fleet is based in Pearl Harbor and not at all on the west coast of the United States continent. Thus, once again, just like in World War II, Oahu has been made a first strike target. And, moreover, the water that cools the nuclear reactors on these submarines must be stored someplace in Hawaii, further endangering our land and people in the event of an accidental spill. We as Indigenous women are the center of our community, and like our Earth Mother, we have nurtured our children, but legal changes have come over the years which have brought about the loss of culture. We as Indigenous women need to have the right to the autonomy of our bodies and minds and retain self-determination over our laws, wisdom, and cultures. Indigenous women living in regional areas in Australia, for example, are being denied access to health services, those comparable to that of urban Australian people. They're having to travel great distances or spend extended periods away from the families and communities. Displacement of communities in Australia into missions in the past has had detrimental, transgenerational effects on the health, both physical and mental, and well-being of Indigenous women and our families. In the Pacific Islands, the rising sea levels are forcing Indigenous peoples off of our lands. This is caused by the ice melts in Antarctica and Arctic Canada. This is an extreme global crisis. Related to this is the phenomenon of coral bleaching due to rising carbon emissions, which leads to the ocean becoming more acidic, which in turn leads to rising ocean temperatures. Heat-intolerant coral cannot survive this. Thus, we are creating biological deserts in the ocean, and these are referred to as dead zones. By 2050, it is predicted that 50% of the world's sea life will die. States are allowing significant overfishing through environmentally unstable and unsustainable fishing practices, such as the use of dynamite and Clorox. When discussions are held on international water concerns, the focus is on trade, whereas the focus needs to be on caring for the oceans. This critical climate change crisis affects Indigenous women's traditional knowledge, including languages and practices of gathering, and our ability to pass on this knowledge to future generations. Therefore, we, the Global Indigenous Women's Caucus, recommend and urge the Permanent Forum to 1. Call on states in the Pacific region to ensure that comprehensive primary health care and interventions are funded to immediately address the inequity in health status. 2. Call on all states to sign the Kyoto Protocol and strongly urge and recommend that the Australian government expedite the national adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the New Zealand government reverse its opposition to this declaration. 3. Call on all UN agencies and states to recognize key rights of Indigenous peoples related to the solutions to climate change, namely the protection of traditional knowledge systems, Indigenous languages, Indigenous models of development, and land, territory, and resource rights that promote ecological sustainability rather than exploitation. 4. Call on all states to enforce effective regulations and institute effective measures in consultation with Indigenous peoples that promote and protect ecological sustainability of the waters and Indigenous people and of Indigenous peoples and sustenance fishing practices. 5. Call on all states to take effective measures to reverse current carbon emission trends that are negatively affecting the Pacific Ocean. And finally, 6, request that the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples come to Hawaii to investigate the adverse effects of the U.S. military occupation of our Hawaiian homeland on our papa, our earth mother, and on her descendants, the Indigenous Hawaiians. I thank you very much.
A Chamorro organization, Indigenous Chamorro Peoples, Nations, and Affiliated Organizations. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Atia Degmizu, Your Excellencies. My name is Julian Uggan, and I have been commissioned to present this collective intervention on behalf of the Chamorro Nation and affiliated Indigenous groups of Guam. I appear before you with the support and blessings of my elders. I address you on behalf of the Indigenous Chamorro people of Guam, an endangered people now being rushed toward full-blown extinction. In 2008, the Chamorro people of Guam braced ourselves for a storm of U.S. militarization so enormous in scope, so volatile in nature, so irreversible in consequence. U.S. military realignment in the Asia-Pacific region seeks to home port 60% of its Pacific fleet in and around our ancient archipelago. With no input from the Indigenous Chamorro people and over deepening dissent, the U.S. plans to flood Guam, its colony in perpetuity, with upwards of 50,000 people, which includes the 8,000 U.S. Marines and their 9,000 dependents being ousted by Okinawa, and an outside labor force estimated upwards of 20,000 workers on construction contracts. In addition, 6 nuclear submarines will be added to the 3 already stationed in Guam, as well as a monstrous global strike force, a strike and intelligence surveillance reconnaissance hub at Anderson Air Force Base. The buildup only complements the impressive Air Force and Navy show of force occupying one-third of our only 30-mile-long island already. This military expansionism exacts devastating consequences on my people, who make up only 37% of the 170,000 people living in Guam and who already suffer the signature maladies of a colonial condition. The militarization of Guam endangers our fundamental and inalienable human right to self-determination, the exercise of which our administering power, the United States, has strategically denied us in glaring betrayal of its international legal obligations under the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, UN General Assembly Resolution 1514, to name just some. The unilateral decision to hyper-militarize our homeland is the latest in a long line of covenant breaches on the part of our administering power to guide Guam toward self-governance. It was made totally without consulting the indigenous people. No public education campaign regarding the social, cultural, and political consequences of this hyper-militarization has been seriously undertaken or even contemplated. For the last 3 years, we have appeared before the UN Special Political and Decolonization Committee, alerting that organ of a campaign of the Guam Chamber of Commerce, primarily consisting of U.S. statesiders, to privatize every one of Guam's public resources, our island's only water provider, only power provider, only local telephone provider, public schools, and its only port, on an island that imports 85% to 90% of its food, and where private monopolies of public goods would truly make us captive to the forces of the market, in short, eating us whole. Not much has changed since we last were here in New York. Our power provider has been privatized, our telecommunications sold. Our only water provider and only port are under relentless attack. We are not Americans. We are Chamorros. We are heirs to an indigenous civilization born 2,000 years before Jesus, and we are being disappeared off your radar. All this, and only 2 years until the end of the second international decade for the eradication of colonialism, and no midterm review by the Special Committee on Decolonization, and no designation of any expert to track Guam's progress or lack thereof toward progressing off the UN list of non-self-governing territories, and no UN visiting mission to Guam. It is a sad commentary that the administering power year after year abstains or votes against UN resolutions addressing the question of Guam and resolutions reflecting the work of the UN on decolonization, including the resolution on the second international decade for the eradication of colonialism, as well as the very recently passed Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. With this non-support by the administering power, it's no wonder that the list of NSGTs under the administration of the U.S. has turned half a century old with such little progress. We Chamorros come to New York year after year, appealing to the UN Decolonization Committee to follow through with its mandate. Indeed, the UN has collected almost 30 years of our testimony with nothing to show for it. I represent today the third generation of Chamorro activists to appear before the UN, desperately trying to safeguard our supposedly inalienable right to self-determination. The failure of the U.S. to honor its international obligations to Guam, the non-responsiveness of the UN Special Committee on Decolonization to our rapid deterioration, and the overall non-performance of relevant U.S. and UN decolonization organs and officials combine to carry our small chance of survival to a final coffin. All this combines to elevate the human rights situation in Guam now as a matter not only of decolonization, but ethnic cleansing. Indeed, when future generations look upon these days, they might come to label Guam not merely a U.S. colony, but a U.N. colony. To date, the forum has deferred to the special committee. The time has come for the forum to take the lead. To this end, we request the forum take the following action. And though we recommend three things, because of brevity, I will only make one recommendation, the most important. We request the forum to immediately sponsor an expert seminar in conjunction with the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination and the Special Committee on Decolonization to examine the impact of the UN decolonization process regarding the indigenous peoples of the non-self-governing territories, now and previously listed on the UN list of NSGTs. This seminar must be under the auspices of the forum due to existing lamentable problems with the Secretariat of the Special Committee. We request that independent expert Carlisle Corbin be included in the seminar, as well as the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples. In solidarity, urgency, and increasing desperation, the Chamorro Nation and Indigenous Chamorro organizations of Guam, with support of many different organizations, including three with ECOSOC credential status. Thank you very much,
Julian Aguon. I now call on Mililani Trask, who will speak on behalf of the Indigenous World Association. Mililani Trask, you have the floor.
I thank you, Madam Chair and members of the forum. This is a global intervention filed in behalf of the indigenous peoples of the Pacific, the Caribbean Antilles, and Puerto Rico. Joining three indigenous NGOs, the Indigenous World Association, the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research Action, and the Aldet Center of St. Lucia, are 17 indigenous organizations representing the peoples of the Hawaiian Archipelago, Easter Island, Rapa Nui, the Caribbean Antilles, Kanaki New Caledonia, French-occupied Polynesia, and the Taino peoples of Puerto Rico. Colleagues of the forum, if you search the annals of international law, you will find that the word sacred is used only once. This is in relation to the sacred trust obligation which administering states have to the inhabitants of the non-self-governing territories under Article 73 of the UN Charter. The sacred obligation is owed to millions of indigenous peoples who reside in the Pacific and Caribbean and who under international law are unable to express their right to self-determination and self-governance because they were placed by the United Nations on a list of non-self-governing territories in the early 1940s. Our peoples remained there for 67 years. The non-self-governing territories are the old world colonies. International law concedes that the peoples of these territories are denied the most fundamental of all human rights, the right to self-governance. Under international law, the states that were designated as administering states were supposed to assist our peoples in attaining a full measure of self-governance, and when this was achieved, our peoples were to be given the opportunity to choose our own form of democratic government, including an independent government. Since the Cold War has ended, only one non-self-governing territory has attained self-governance, Timor-Leste. Several non-self-governing territories remain in a state of political disenfranchisement as colonies of the United Nations system. These are Guam, American Samoa, Kanaki, New Caledonia, Pitcairn Island, the Tokelau Islands, and Puerto Rico. There are serious concerns that have yet to be addressed relating to French-occupied Polynesia, Easter Island Rapa Nui, and Hawaii and Alaska. Forum colleagues, we have to point out that the Special Committee on Decolonization, which has oversight of this process, is dysfunctional and for the past 15 years has refused to respond to several United Nations General Assembly resolutions. The record reveals the following. From 2002 to 2005, the United Nations General Assembly passed 19 resolutions directing that specific action be taken to implement the decolonization of these territories. These actions were supposed to be taken by UNEP, UNDP, the UN Secretary General, the UN Regional Economic Commission, the President of the ECOSOC, the Chairman of the Special Committee on Decolonization, and the state administering agents. Not a single directive in the 19 resolutions has been implemented. In 2006, the General Assembly of Nations adopted a plan of implementation to move forward with an implementation strategy for the territories. Nothing has been implemented under the program of implementation. For 10 years, the Caribbean community states have repeatedly requested that the Secretariat of the Special Committee produce reports relating to the implementation of these resolutions. The reports were to be prepared in behalf of the Secretary General, but no reports have ever been initiated by the Secretariat of the Special Committee. During this period, the CERT itself has repeatedly requested that the Special Committee and its Secretariat provide information to the CERT on racism in the territories. These requests have been ignored, and every year we see the CERT reports, the same sentence. They regret and lament the fact that they receive only scant information from the Special Committee. It appears that we are dealing with a situation of institutionalized racism. The situation is so outrageous that the current policy of the Special Committee on Decolonization is referred to as a policy of colonial accommodation in the Overseas Territory Report. Members of the forum, the United Nations Permanent Forum itself addressed these issues in its 2004 report. In recommendation number 54, the forum requested the special rapporteur to undertake a study of the decal process and its impact on our human rights. In addition, in 2004, the Permanent Forum requested that the Secretary General undertake a mid-decade review on the second decade to eradicate colonialism. Forum experts, it appears that your recommendations are also now being ignored. The Pacific and Caribbean Caucus would like to point out to the forum that on December 14, 2006, the United Nations General Assembly adopted Resolution 61128, requesting that the Permanent Forum, the Special Committee, and the CERD commence working together to exchange information on the developments in the non-self-governing territories. That was a General Assembly resolution to this body. In 2 years, the forum has waited for the Special Committee. The indigenous peoples of the Pacific and the Caribbean must now request that the forum take the action, because we do not believe that the Special Committee is capable of doing it. Consequently, we bring to the forum the following three recommendations: to sponsor the expert seminar in conjunction with the CERD and the Special Committee. We believe that this has to be under the auspices of the forum. As our intervention states, we believe that the Special Committee is suffering from institutionalized racism. We also request that the UN Special Rapporteur and expert Carlisle Corbin be included, and that we, the indigenous peoples of the non-self-governing territories, also be included. We request that the forum utilize the interagency support group to make the agencies obey the United Nations General Assembly resolutions to force the agencies to implement decolonization. We can use the interagency support group for this. And finally, we request that the forum communicate its concerns for the human rights violations, not only against indigenous peoples, but the non-indigenous peoples of the non-self-governing territories, that you communicate this to the UN Human Rights Council and request now that they designate a special rapporteur on the human rights and situation of the peoples, all of them, of the non-self-governing territories. I look forward to working with you to implement these recommendations. Thank you, forum experts.
Merci, Madame Miliani. Le forum permanent est à l'écoute de vos recommandations et nous ferons en sorte de donner des réponses à toutes vos préoccupations. À présent, nous passons à... C'est Madame, hein? À Kaiaopua Fife de Hawaï, représentant de Kohani Foundation. La personne est-elle dans la salle?
Personne?
Je passe alors à la personne suivante sur ma liste. Malia Nobrega, du Caucus du Pacifique. Ah, oui, elle est là. Vous avez déjà parlé, madame. La personne suivante.
Madame la présidente.
Monsieur du collectif de Hawaï.
Non, je parle.
Vous parlez à la place de...
Ça va?
OK, allez-y, monsieur.
Merci, madame la présidente. Mon nom est Sarimine Bouinki et je
Je voudrais intervenir au nom de l'Agence Kanak de développement, du Conseil national des droits du peuple autochtone de Kanaky-Nouvelle-Calédonie, du COGERN et du Sénat coutumier. Les recommandations que je voudrais présenter en premier pour ne pas perdre trop de temps. Nous souhaitons que l'instance permanente recommande aux États membres qui ont ou qui assument la responsabilité d'administrer des peuples autochtones du Pacifique de mettre en œuvre sans attendre la Déclaration des Nations Unies sur le droit des peuples autochtones. La seconde, que l'instance permanente intervienne auprès du gouvernement de la France afin de permettre au rapporteur spécial des Nations Unies sur la situation des droits de l'homme et des droits fondamentaux des peuples autochtones de visiter la Nouvelle-Calédonie ainsi que les deux autres territoires français que sont la Polynésie française et Wallis et Futuna et qu'il vous fasse rapport circonstancié de ces visites. La Charte des Nations Unies affirme que les peuples des Nations Unies sont résolus à recourir aux institutions internationales pour favoriser le progrès économique et social de tous les peuples. Les membres des Nations Unies qui ont ou qui assument la responsabilité d'administrer des territoires dont les populations ne s'administrent pas encore complètement reconnaissent le principe de la primauté des intérêts des habitants de ces territoires. La situation actuelle des peuples autochtones du Pacifique résulte d'une époque que les Nations Unies ont condamnée dès l'établissement de la Charte des Nations Unies, l'époque coloniale, quelques trois siècles après la colonisation du continent dit américain. Aujourd'hui, les Nations Unies continuent de travailler à l'éradication de ce fléau, mais la situation des peuples autochtones du Pacifique reste quand même une situation coloniale tant que ces peuples n'auront pas exercé leur droit à l'autodétermination, un droit reconnu à tous les peuples de notre planète par la même Charte des Nations Unies. Je ne vous ferai pas la correction de rappeler le contenu de la Déclaration des Nations Unies sur les droits des peuples autochtones, mais il est regrettable de constater que, en 2008, en Nouvelle-Calédonie, soit 10 ans après la signature de l'accord de Nouméa affirmant l'existence du peuple Kanak, que ce peuple autochtone est toujours en butte à des violations de ses droits fondamentaux. De graves abus persistent à cet égard et ils ont souvent pour cause des préjugés et des attitudes discriminatoires liées à une recolonisation de l'intérieur de nos pays par une société dominante qui refuse toute compréhension des droits autochtones. Une société dominante non autochtone, aux méthodes de gouvernance sans aucune considération liées à l'unité culturelle ou à la structure politique historique des peuples autochtones. Pour le peuple Kanak, la revendication et la réappropriation de ces terres et territoires ancestraux, spoliés durant la colonisation, s'avèrent de plus en plus impossibles du fait des politiques foncières menées par les autorités gouvernementales locales pour satisfaire les besoins en logement d'une population nouvellement immigrée ou ceux en espace d'implantation de projets industriels. D'autre part, de grands projets d'exploitation minière et d'usines de traitement du minerai sont imposés au peuple Kanak en violation du principe du consentement préalable, éclairé et librement consenti. Ces grands projets représentent avant tout des investissements étrangers et sont également des menaces à l'existence même du peuple Kanak de par la destruction d'une importante partie de la biodiversité terrestre et marine sur de grands espaces qui sont les domaines traditionnels de chasse et de pêche du peuple Kanak ou hébergent des sites sacrés. Les Nations Unies ont déjà affirmé et réaffirmé la préoccupation que leur inspirent toutes les activités visant à exploiter les ressources naturelles que sont les patrimoines des peuples des territoires non autonomes, y compris des populations autochtones du Pacifique, de même que leurs ressources au détriment des intérêts de ces peuples et de façon à les empêcher d'exercer leurs droits sur ces ressources. L'instance permanente a constaté avec préoccupation que les questions autochtones sont souvent absentes de l'action menée en faveur des objectifs du millénaire pour le développement et de la lutte contre la pauvreté. En Nouvelle-Calédonie, les autorités gouvernementales ne semblent pas avoir pris connaissance de l'existence même des objectifs du millénaire. De plus, elles font la sourde oreille aux appels au respect des droits du peuple autochtone. L'instance permanente, Madame la Présidente, a souligné la contribution de la démilitarisation des terres et territoires des peuples autochtones à la paix, au progrès économique et social et au développement. L'Assemblée générale des Nations Unies a déjà appelé les puissances administrantes à ne pas mener des manœuvres militaires, à ne pas construire de nouvelles bases militaires et à démanteler les bases existantes. C'est le contraire qui se passe dans notre pays avec les exercices militaires organisés par la puissance administrante avec le concours des forces militaires des États voisins. Tout cela, Madame la Présidente, contribue à maintenir le peuple autochtone sous le joug colonial par le biais d'une société dominante créée par cette puissance et obéissant aux intérêts étrangers qui pillent les ressources naturelles du peuple autochtone en refusant de respecter les droits fondamentaux du peuple Kanak, notamment au regard des principes du consentement préalable et consenti en connaissance de cause et du principe d'accord sur les impacts et les bénéfices. Voici quelques raisons, Madame la Présidente, pour demander à l'instance permanente d'interpeller les États au nom du respect de la Déclaration sur les droits des peuples autochtones et d'intervenir auprès du gouvernement de la France afin que le rapporteur spécial des Nations Unies sur les situations des droits de l'homme et des droits fondamentaux des peuples autochtones puisse visiter la Nouvelle-Calédonie et vous faire rapport circonstancié de ces visites. Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Merci, monsieur. S'il vous plaît, pourriez-vous me rappeler votre nom? Sarimine.
Avec le développement.
OK, merci. La prochaine personne à parler, c'est Maliano Brega du caucus du Pacifique. Asseyez-vous. Ah oui, vous avez fini. Et c'est Les Malaiser du
Australian Aboriginal.
De l'association Australian Aboriginal. OK.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we now have a change of government in Australia and have received a clear and unequivocal commitment from the new government to support the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Only days ago, a national summit held by the government indicated that there may be growing national support for a treaty or constitutional reform to promote and protect the rights of the Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Our presentation here is now structured to describe our circumstances in Australia in accordance with the rights contained in the Declaration. Under the general principles, the Government of Australia has not yet recognised our right to self-determination. Also, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination has, since 1998, consistently ruled and reminded Australia that it is discriminating against our rights to our lands, territories and resources, and has called upon the government to comply with its obligations under the Race Discrimination Treaty. In addition, the government has, since last year, suspended the operation of the Racial Discrimination Act in Australia and implemented new laws which violate Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander freedoms contained in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And with few exceptions, such as land councils of New South Wales and the Northern Territory, we have no capacity to maintain and strengthen our own political, legal, economic, social and cultural institutions as described in Article 5 of the Declaration. In relation to our life, integrity and security, Article 7 says that we have the collective rights to live in freedom, peace and security as distinct peoples, and Article 8 states we have the right to be free from forced assimilation and propaganda and incitement of racial discrimination. This right is clearly violated by the new laws known as the Northern Territory Intervention and the Queensland Family Responsibility Laws. These laws recreate the reserves environment by, inter alia, giving police and special task forces star chamber powers, that is, special powers, over Aboriginal people, controlling incomes of families and victimising the targeted peoples on the grounds of our race, and yet these laws do not apply to any non-Indigenous Australians. Just 2 days ago, the Premier of Queensland, in fact, vowed to force communities to re-establish, quote, normal, end quote, family values and behaviour. The Premier said, parents who don't send their children to school, those who abuse or neglect their children, and people who trash their homes, and in this she means Aboriginal people, could have their welfare payments managed. And then the Premier said, this is a bold experiment, a world first. Somehow they thought that that was good. Under economic and social rights, our rights to free, prior, informed consent are not recognised in Australia. In 2006, the government abolished the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Commission, a body that was well known to this permanent forum and the United Nations generally for its sustained efforts to establish international standards on Indigenous rights and the special mechanisms we now enjoy on Indigenous issues. Since this demise of ATSIC, the governments at the national and state levels have acted with impunity to withdraw financial assistance to communities, to exercise direct control over the management and operation of community organisations, and to prevent the advocacy of Indigenous rights and human rights generally by our peoples. The government has continued to deny our land rights, the ownership of our lands, territories and resources, and prevented our own means of subsistence and economic development. Despite ample evidence of the existence of these rights in Australia, we are opposed by governments in establishing our rights over waters, seas and reefs, and in the use of the resources in all our territories. And only yesterday, the Australian courts overturned an important decision that was supporting Aboriginal rights to own our lands, territories and resources based upon native title laws by the government. This was known as the Noongar case. These recent policies of government, including of the new government, are forcing breakdown of communal title to create long-term leases for theoretical enterprises and private home ownership. The enforced changes, without our free prior informed consent, prevent our peoples from developing more appropriate means to ensure our political, social, cultural and economic survival and growth over our future generations. We call upon the Government of Australia to commit to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and to end all discriminatory and oppressive laws which currently exist in Australia. Madam Chair, the recommendations are that we support the recommendations already provided by the Pacific Caucus and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner. We request that the Permanent Forum seek a response from the Government of Australia to the many matters raised in this and other relevant interventions and give time, as may be appropriate in this forum, so the Government can present suitable responses. We, the combined delegations from Australia, invite the chairperson of the Permanent Forum to visit Australia and, if possible, to participate in a meeting that can be arranged by the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner and our member, Professor Mick Dodson, between the Government of Australia and representatives chosen by Indigenous peoples to discuss our rights and the Declaration. We recommend the Government of Australia issue an open invitation to the UN's special mechanisms to visit Australia and to examine the situation of the rights and freedoms of Indigenous peoples, and that the Government give due and sufficient weight to the recommendations that come from those examinations. And we recommend the Government of Australia increase the capacity of the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission so that it can effectively promote and protect the rights of Indigenous peoples, including promoting the Declaration, and to address the continuing racial discrimination in Australia, including racial vilification and racial profiling of our population in mainstream media and in government statements. And finally, Madam Chair, we recommend that the Secretary to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues communicate that he send a letter to the Commonwealth Secretariat so that the Commonwealth of Nations might also endorse the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples and have those effectively promoted throughout Commonwealth countries, and recommend in that communication that the Commonwealth, in association with Indigenous Peoples, establish a working group to promote the implementation of the Declaration consistent with the plan of action of the second decade. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Merci, Monsieur Malaiser. Je tiens à vous remercier au nom de l'instance et en mon nom personnel pour les deux propositions d'invitation que vous venez de faire. À présent, nous allons appeler Monsieur Pelpina Saoureka de Alifounou. Il est là? Ah, ok. Allez-y.
Merci. Merci, Madame Chair. Since time immemorial, the Alifurus have been the original inhabitants of our ancestral land, Maluku, and deep seas like the Banda and the Arafura seas. Western colonialism came and cursed us into the artificial entity of the colonial empire, and were we forced to give up our ancestral name of Alifuru. Alifuru was considered cannibalistic, savage, and civilized. We were not only losing our identity, but were placed and regulated according to the colonialist administrative convenience and military strategy. Nevertheless, there were numerous uprisings by our people against Dutch colonial rule. The entire population of the island of Banda was wiped out and the spice plantations burned to the ground when the indigenous Alifurus in Banda attempted to evade that monopoly on the spices. With the naked aggression by Indonesian forces in September 1950 against the sovereign Maluku people, Dutch colonialism was replaced by Indonesian neocolonialism. When colonialism is wrong, then neocolonialism that is squarely based on it is also wrong. Until today, Maluku is suffering under Indonesian neocolonialism in all its forms and manifestations. The people is still striving to achieve their national aspirations to regain their identity as Alifurus in their own sovereign nation. Last year, on June 28, 2007, a young of young Moluccans performed the traditional Alifuru dance in front of the Indonesian President Yudhoyono, who came to Maluku to launch the Indonesian National Family Planning. The Alifuru dancers were captured, beaten, and immediately detained. They received no adequate legal assistance whatsoever. In March 2008, the trials against the Alifuru dancers started. The Indonesian judge ruled treason, and the verdict was 20 years to life imprisonment. The others who were still awaiting trial would face at least 40 years imprisonment for having participated in performing the traditional Alifuru dances. Last year, on December 12, 2007, the Commander-in-Chief, General Rashid Kunan Akiri of the occupying Indonesian military forces in Maluku, has declared that any Moluccan suspicious of possessing and or manifesting adherence to the RMS would be shot at place. In comparison, the commander of the Laskar Jihad forces, Jafar Umar Talib, responsible for instigating, provocating hatred and cold-bloodedly killing of thousands of Moluccans, babies, children, women from 2000 to 2004, enjoyed full impunity and no accountability until now. The Indonesian military and special forces, guilty of crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in Maluku, enjoy immunity and no accountability until now. The suspected perpetrators held responsible for the violence in Timor-Leste have been released after some 3 years of imprisonment. The perpetrators of the Bali bombers did not even receive such high sentences for the international crimes that they committed without remorse. We ask the Permanent Forum to take the request to request the Human Rights Commission to undertake again a UPR on Indonesia's systematic violations of the human rights charters, and this time by hearing our suppressed voices. To request the Economic and Social Council to recognize the true aspirations of the indigenous Alifuru people of Maluku against the colonization and neocolonizations. To request the Decolonization Committee to take the Maluku case on the agenda. In the case of the Alifuru detainees imprisoned for expressing their cultural heritage, I would say Indonesia has voted in favor of the declaration on the rights of indigenous issues. Based on this declaration, the indigenous peoples have the right to the expression and safeguarding of their cultural heritage. This is also in Article 8, 9, 11, 12, 13, etc. of the draft of the declaration. We therefore request the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Issues, to take this matter up as an urgent action for the speedy release of the Alifuru detainees who were imprisoned for the expressing of the cultural heritage. We request the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to ask the WHO and any other specialized agencies to help the parents, including mothers, sisters, and pregnant wives, with adequate psychological counseling in this traumatic experience they have to endure. Merci beaucoup, Madame Chair.
Merci, Madame. Nous passons maintenant à Ronald Wahomi de l'association West Papua Interest Association. Vous avez la parole, monsieur.
Distinguished Madam Chair of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to present some of the views of West Papua Indigenous people. Before I present some of the views in this very important event, allow me to express my feeling of pride and happiness in attending the seventh session of the UNPFII. I want also expressing my gratitude to the Secretariat of the UNPFII, who worked very hard to host this event. On behalf of West Papua Indigenous people, we express our deepest appreciation for the recent adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We are proud to be Indigenous people. Indigenous people are rich of tradition and contribute to cultural diversity. We hope that during the second decade and before the end of the Millennium Development Goals, we will be able to develop our aspiration and future, including welfare, and contribute to the development of the world Indigenous people, and particularly West Papua Indigenous people, who are denied their rights and demand attention. We West Papua Indigenous people continue to suffer discrimination, marginalization, acting poverty, conflict, and human rights abuses. We face disposition of our traditional lands and livelihoods, displacement, destruction of our belief system, cultural language, race, and way of life if under threat of extinction. Over 45 years since 1963, our human rights and fundamental freedom in West Papua have never been fully guaranteed. These have been impeding the economic and social development of the Indigenous people in West Papua. The presence of the Bill of Law of the Republic of Indonesia No. 21 of the year 2001 on the special autonomy to Papua does not guarantee fully the freedom of expression of West Papuan rights and fundamental freedom that are protected by international instruments. The international cooperation in the special autonomy in Papua led by ILO, UNDP, UNICEF, etc. is ineffective in implementing the rules necessary to the needs of Indigenous people who are living in precarious conditions and experiment on development, unemployment, poverty, discrimination, lack of education, and health services. Indigenous people from West Papua are far from having reached the Millennium Development Goals. In the era of the special autonomy amidst various humanitarian problems, although the special autonomy was granted as means to provide a solution to improve the life of Indigenous people in West Papua, the human rights violations have increased, health problems have not been taken care of, education, infrastructure, and welfare problems persist and increasingly deteriorate. On 12 August 2005, Indigenous people of West Papua did demonstration in the street of Jayapura to show their opposition to the special autonomy that did bring an appropriate solution to resolve the problem faced by West Papua Indigenous people. Dividing the Papua province by the decree of President No. 1 of the year 2003 into three provinces in development program, ignore the special autonomy and turn West Papuan Indigenous people of 1.5 million into minority ethnic Negroid race. The West Papua Indigenous people became lost into majority two of 210 million population of Indonesia. Many foreign Indonesian settlers came to occupy the land and heritage of West Papua. As the special autonomy failed, a new presidential decree No. 5 was enacted in 2007. This presidential decree No. 5 promoted the acceleration of the development in Papua and West Papua province and ignored the autonomy and authority of the central government. The province have sent down 11 ministers to implement the provision related to development contained in this new decree. This was done against the spirit of the special autonomy for Papua. The regulation No. 77 of the year 2007 prohibited the Morning Star flag symbol as a cultural emblem, although the symbol had been determined by the Papua People Assembly, MRP, and Papua People House Representative, DPRP, according to Article 2 of the Bill of Law of the Special Autonomy. The regulation No. 78 of the year 2007 divided the province of Papua Barat Daya province, Papua Tengah, and Papua Selatan, thus ignoring the Bill of Law or Special Autonomy for Papua. This will bring more military that will occupy the territory and increase human rights violation. Today, West Papua Indigenous people demand peace and justice. West Papua Indigenous people call upon the United Nations for the realization of the provision contained in the Article 3 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which states that Indigenous people have the right to self-determination and the right to freely determine their political status. Self-determination will enable Indigenous people in West Papua to reach the Millennium Development Goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ronald Warumi, West Papua Interest Association. I now call on Jethro Tulin, Friends of the Earth, Papua New Guinea. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, madam. A joint submission by Friends of the Earth International on behalf of our Tank Association, Papua New Guinea, intervention by Lake Kawamoga and the Kulara United Families of the Wujara Nation, Australia, Western Institute of Defense Project, Nevada, USA, Indigenous People Links, Canada, Center for Organization, Research and Education, Lent is Life, Madam Chair, ours is a clash of civilization, prevailed by large state services. My Hengan and Uli people in the islands of Papua New Guinea have shot from the Costonite an age of truce sustainability to dispatch in one generation, with stunning results for some tribesmen who in their youth, when grass was prone and spread fanatically, we started with better paradise feathers, now have health care and modern homes. But the majority are reeling from the impact of cash for land deals that have turned their traditions upside down and their ancestral home into industrial moonscape, paralleled by guards and police, including one of Papua New Guinea's notorious mobile units, renowned for savage human rights abuses, including killings. The Pogara mine case is a textbook case for what can go wrong when large-scale mining companies confront indigenous peoples, including the impacts of its projects and resorting to guns court when people rebel against it. These impacts of the project and resorting to, outrages the consensus of local indigenous communities, especially when the mine is right next to our homes. My people are exposed to dangerous chemicals like cyanide and mercury. Some of our people drown in the tailings and waste during floods and fishing stock. Flora and fauna are depleted down the river system, leading to indigenous food sources being threatened. To date, it has been primarily the responsibility of the PNG government to ensure that the PNG mines do not violate indigenous people's rights. This reflects the power historically wielded by the state, both individually and collectively through institutions like the UN. However, the increasing global power and influence of transnationals like the Canadian Barrick Gold International, managers of the Pogara mine, that they, alongside the PNG government, must be responsible for upholding human rights within the spires of influence. Madam Chair, in the opening statement for the 7th Permanent Forum, the Bolivian President, Evo Morales, drew a focus to how democracy and capitalism have destroyed traditional values and cultures of indigenous communities around the world. Madam Chair, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the national goals and directive principles that underlie the PNG Constitutional Code are not only the moral responsibility to uphold rights of affected indigenous peoples in PNG, but also it is increasingly seen as implying their legal liability as organs of society to respect, promote, and secure human rights. Renowned international legal scholar Professor Louis Ankins stated that every individual on every organ of society, exclusive, no one, no company, no cyberspace, the Universal Declaration applies to them all. Madam Chair, therefore, we recommend that calls for an activation of the 2005 Extractive Industries Review for activation of the previous intervention to address the impact and legacy of extractive industries on indigenous lands, territories, and natural resources, urgently call for funding through ECOSAT for a world summit to seek solutions for indigenous nations and people affected by extractive industries in order to complete recommendations by 2009 for the 2010 Commission on Sustainable Development, investigate how to set up an indigenous arbitration system, a regulatory regime to control the practices of national mining companies, other extractive industries, forestry and fisheries, requires UN agency to build on the research done by NGOs to document the holistic impact of mining on indigenous communities, including environmental justice, the legacy of mining waste, destroyed square sites, degraded lands, and poisoned waters. Form an agency to evaluate the amount indigenous communities involuntarily subsidized by mining industry and other extractive industry to the natural resources, with a size with minimal compensation, if any, by forms of colonialism perpetrated by transnational companies. Madam Chair, we call for an expert workshop drawing on all expert investigation into mining impacts on indigenous nations and people, such as the Committee on Elimination for all forms of racial discrimination. Observation on both Canada and the U.S. must regulate their transnational corporations impacting indigenous communities outside their borders. Madam Chair, not but last but at least, regards a joint report before 8th Permanent Forum from the Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General on Business and Human Rights and a Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedom of Indigenous People identifying transnationals and their type of behavior which breaches the inherent right detailed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. 7. Create an Indigenous Network on Mining Activities. We call on everyone at this forum to begin their network. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jethro Tulin, Friends of the Earth, Papua New Guinea. I now call on Alanud Ferial Abunadi, the Negev Coexist Forum. You have the floor, sir. It's not in the room? Sorry. So we can go to Mariva Neti Dumontlok Hiti Tau Pufena Pumutmetua. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Your Honor to all of us. Depuis l'arrêt des essais nucléaires français menés de 1966 à 1995 sur les atolls de Mururoa et Fangataufa, en Polynésie française, le traité de Rarotonga fait du Pacifique une zone dénucléarisée. Mais ce traité concernant la zone Pacifique ne prévoit pas de clause engageant la responsabilité des puissances coloniales ayant généré des expérimentations nucléaires quant aux impacts et conséquences tant des explosions aériennes et souterraines nucléaires. En Polynésie française, au cœur du Pacifique Sud, s'étend l'archipel des îles Tuamotu, composé de récifs coralliens situés au niveau de l'océan, représentant à lui seul 20% des atolls de notre planète. De 1966 à 1974, 46 tirs aériens ont lieu au-dessus des atolls de Mururoa et Fangataufa, dispersant des matières nucléaires et polluant très gravement pour des centaines de générations ce que la nature et les récifs ont mis des millénaires à édifier. Sous la pression internationale, les tirs aériens cessent en 1974, mais les essais souterrains prennent le relais jusqu'en 1995. Officiellement, 18% des tirs souterrains ont provoqué des fuites radioactives qui contaminent les sols et les lagons, ainsi que la biosphère des îles. Les risques de relâchement de ces matières nucléaires dans l'environnement ne sont pas hypothétiques, puisque les atolls ont été ébranlés dans leur structure géologique et que des effondrements se sont déjà produits. Les sous-sols des atolls de Mururoa et Fangataufa doivent être considérés en raison des matières nucléaires contenues comme contaminées pour des générations. Une autre menace est également présente, car sur la surface des atolls de Mururoa et Fangataufa, toujours tenus au secret et gardés par des militaires, plusieurs déchets radioactifs sont enfouis sous des chapes de béton, creusées dans un substrat poreux, comme le corail. Qu'en est-il de l'étanchéité de ces chapes de béton avec la montée des eaux qui petit à petit submergent nos atolls? En 100 ans, la radioactivité artificielle a augmenté de 30%. Les taux de cancer, notamment de la thyroïde, sont 3 fois plus importants en Polynésie que dans le reste du monde. C'est aussi le cas pour les leucémies. Après l'Holocauste de Tchernobyl, l'organe international indépendant du CRIRAD sur les conséquences nucléaires est devenu célèbre pour ses travaux sur les questions nucléaires. La France l'a d'ailleurs nommé pour faire un rapport sur les conséquences géomécaniques à Mururoa et Fangataufa. Existe également la commission COSCEN, commission basée localement à Tahiti. Le traité de Rarotonga ne prévoit pas de clause engageant la responsabilité des puissances nucléaires. À cause de cette omission, les puissances coloniales qui ont exposé le Pacifique et la Polynésie aux contaminations nucléaires ne prennent pas en compte les conséquences des précédents tests de surface ou souterrain sur l'environnement et la santé. Membre de l'instance, l'article 29 de la Déclaration sur les droits des peuples autochtones traite de la situation de notre peuple en établissant nos droits à conserver et protéger notre environnement et qui interdit aux États de stocker ou de disposer de matières dangereuses sur les terres et territoires maori sans notre consentement volontaire, préalable et informé. C'est pourquoi nous demandons à ce que les puissances nucléaires aient leurs responsabilités engagées, passées, présentes ou à venir, et ce jusqu'à l'extinction de la nocivité des explosions nucléaires provoquées sur nos îles, mais également des impacts qui pourraient être encourus par nos voisins de tout le Pacifique. Également, nous implorons le Forum afin qu'elle apporte son soutien à la pérennité de la commission Koskken, qui est en ce moment même en danger, afin qu'elle puisse continuer son travail en coordination avec la CRIRAD. Également, que les victimes des explosions nucléaires aient droit à des soins adéquats et à des compensations. Merci, Madame Chair.
Thank you very much. Mariva Nerti de Montluc. I now call on Eritive Rapa Nui Parliament. You have the floor, Madam.
Madam Chair, distinguished representative, the historical approval of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People validates the tireless struggle of Indigenous people worldwide for recognition of our rights, our identity as people, cultures, and heritage. The Declaration, it is indeed a great achievement, but it is true, its true and lasting value will depend not only on our collective ability to translate it into substantive and sustainable action. More importantly, it is in the effective vindication of our right to our land, territory, and resources. Poverty of Indigenous people is intimately linked to economic, social, political, and cultural marginalization. Therefore, for us to pursue our own self-determined development, we have to enforce the right to permanent sovereignty over our lands, territory, and natural resources. Decisions and development initiatives in our territories has to be led on our principle according to our needs. Our survival as Indigenous people, we depend in a considerable way on our natural resources and biodiversity. We live in a fragile ecosystem at serious risk from degradation and desertification among the Pacific Islands. As custodian of our rights, needs to be acknowledged and support our capability and capacity to manage our territory in a sustainable way. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you very much, Eriti Peve. I now call on Tiana Tuno from the Indigenous ICT Task Force.
Kia ora, tēnā koutou, Madam Chair, experts of the forum. My name is Tiana Tuno. I'm from the Ngāi Takoto Ngāpuhi tribes. I'm a Māori from Aotearoa. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the International Indigenous ICT Task Force, an organisation which came out of the World Summit on the Information Society. One of the aims of that process was to set up an Indigenous portal, and we launched that here last year. Indigenous peoples are a valuable part of the Information Society, and this portal is a place to share with our voices our traditions, values, history, as well as our aspirations for the future in a way that supports the work of the global Indigenous community. That portal is now a reality, and the NGO Pacific Voices is the editorial collective collating relevant content for the Pacific region. We did a follow-up site event this year to highlight the direction we are taking. We also launched our logo competition, and more information can be found at indigenousportal.com if you'd like to enter. The story of the Indigenous portals has had its ups and its downs. Indigenous connectivity is an issue that still needs to be urgently addressed. We are also concerned that Indigenous communications, Indigenous activities, and legitimate political dissent are being labelled terrorism. On October 15th last year, the Indigenous portal was taken offline after the server was seized by the New Zealand police over alleged terrorist activity. Māori and other activists had houses raided and arrests were made across the country under anti-terrorism legislation enacted in the wake of September 11. Our programmer and technical support person was arrested at gunpoint by a large number of police in the suburb of Manurewa. He was incarcerated for a month and we've now got him out on bail. Family members of that household were taken and placed face down in the gutter with guns to their heads. One of them was a 12-year-old girl. I was also detained and separated from my partner and children as a large number of police came through my house where they accused me of being part of a terrorist organisation. A number of articles were confiscated, including this laptop that I'm reading from. The Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples, the Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights, and the Secretary-General's Special Representative on Human Rights Defenders all expressed their concern about the detention of Māori and others using the Terrorism Suppression Act by the New Zealand Government. New Zealand's position on the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples also illustrates this lack of respect for Indigenous peoples' rights. Consequently, the Indigenous portal is now being hosted by our Mohawk brothers and sisters in the community of Kanawagi. And we continue to see ICTs as a powerful medium to support the work of Indigenous peoples. ICTs cross borders, cultures. It also fosters an environment where the exchange of information and knowledge can take place. The Indigenous portal seeks partnerships that use the Indigenous portal as a platform to create ICT and media initiatives to support the work that we are doing today. We have the following recommendations. Governments should not use terrorism as an excuse to censor Indigenous dissent or limit the freedom of speech. The Permanent Forum and other UN agencies such as the ITU should support Indigenous-led ICT initiatives. Our logo and the link on your website would be a good start. And we continue to call for universal Indigenous connectivity and the development of Indigenous-specific ICTs. These should be viewed as a necessity for healthy communities. Nō reira, aku tuahine, aku tuakana, aku teina, tēnā te mihi atu ki a koutou katoa. Thank you, Madam Chair, and experts of the forum.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tiano Tuno from the Indigenous ICT Task Force. I'd like to call now on Gary Thomas, the National Indigenous Higher Education Network Australia. You have the floor, sir.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we thank you for the opportunity to speak to the forum and we'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and pay our respects to elders both past and present. The National Indigenous Higher Education Network makes the following statement. Indigenous Australian educational access, participation and completion rates continue to be significantly lower than the national average. This is due to the appalling socioeconomic status of Indigenous people and inconsistent access and service delivery across the country. The rate of Indigenous employment within higher education is also lower in comparison to that of other Australians. Regarding the training of professionals, there is insufficient Indigenous Australian content within courses in Australian universities. This continues to affect the quality of service delivery to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Australia is yet to acknowledge and accept that it has two knowledge systems, the Indigenous knowledge systems and the imposed Western knowledge systems. However, where Indigenous knowledge is recognised, we must ensure Indigenous control, ownership and cultural integrity are protected and maintained. We also need to ensure that Indigenous peoples remain custodians of this knowledge and are not marginalised. To retain Indigenous integrity and control, the National Indigenous Higher Education Advisory Council is undertaking a scoping study for the establishment of a National Indigenous Knowledges Academy. A human rights-based approach to education is essential. Madam Chair, we make two recommendations. One, we request members of the forum note the concerns of the National Indigenous Higher Education Network and encourage Australia to address these issues. Two, in recognition that Indigenous education is a global concern, we request the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues to call on the Human Rights Council to establish a special rapporteur for Indigenous education. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gary Thomas, National Indigenous Higher Education Network, Australia. I now call on Norman Lang, New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I take this opportunity to provide the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues with this statement on land rights in the state of New South Wales and Australia, and the role of the steward and member organisations in delivering benefits from this system. I also wish to take this opportunity to discuss some of the specific issues affecting Aboriginal peoples in New South Wales and to offer our commitment to work in solidarity with Indigenous peoples across the Pacific region. The land rights system was established in 1983 under the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act to support the local Aboriginal Land Council network and empower Aboriginal communities in New South Wales. Our system is made up of 121 local Aboriginal land councils across 9 regions. Each region is represented by an elected councillor. The combined membership of the Aboriginal Land Rights Network in New South Wales is over 20,000 people, and the system provides employment for over 300 people, the overwhelming majority of whom are Aboriginal. A considerable strength of the land rights system in New South Wales is an investment fund of over $700 million Australian dollars. It is important to note that this fund has to be maintained in perpetuity to deliver the benefits to Aboriginal people and provide financial support for the entire system. In addition to this fund, the combined land councils in New South Wales own over 1% of the entire land mass, held in freehold title, providing the membership with the capacity to determine how this land can provide most benefit for our people. We proudly regard the land rights system in New South Wales as the best in the world, but this is not to say that the system is without its considerable challenges. The vision of the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council is to liberate and empower Aboriginal people in New South Wales through economic and social independence. In accordance with our corporate priorities, our values, and the responsibility that we have been entrusted with by our people and our communities, we seek to, one, assist in ensuring Aboriginal people in New South Wales enjoy a sustainable social and cultural environment by seeking to close the gap on poverty and improve health and living standards through tightly targeted community benefit schemes and evidence-based advocacy. Number two, target and increase our advocacy towards relevant state and federal bodies or agencies, particularly funding agencies. Number three, assist our people in having access to and contributing towards a sustainable economic environment, including appropriate education and training and sustainable enjoyment. And four, promote safe and secure environments for our people and our communities. Madam Chairperson, the 7th session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues has been made aware and will no doubt receive further information regarding the degrading and unjust approach to Aboriginal policy in Australia, that is the Northern Territory intervention. The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council fully supports and agrees with the concerns, anger and frustration expressed at this session by our sisters and brothers from Northern Australia in relation to this intervention. I would also like to provide the Permanent Forum members with an understanding of the other side of the spectrum, that is, the lack of an effective policy approach by the Australian New South Wales governments to addressing the problems faced by Aboriginal people in our state. Aboriginal people and communities in New South Wales are subjected to the same level of demonisation as our northern brothers and sisters for our experiences of disadvantage, yet we are left largely to the mercy of mainstream government service providers. These very same service providers have failed us in the past and continue to fail us today. As an example, much publicity has been given to the Little Children of Sacred report into child sexual assault, but scant response has been provided to the Breaking the Silence report dealing with the same issue in the state of New South Wales. A Northern Territory-style intervention is not the answer, but the lack of an effective response to our situation in New South Wales is an abrogation of government responsibility. The Australian government has made much of its apology to the stolen generations in this forum, and we as an organisation commend the Prime Minister for the generosity of spirit in which this parliamentary motion was given. This is an important admission that forcibly removing Aboriginal children from their families, consecutive governments committed gross violations of our human rights. A formal apology is vital, but further reparations are required. We therefore recommend that the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues calls for a resolution through the Economic and Social Council calling on all governments who have forcibly removed Indigenous children from their families to provide a full suite of reparations consistent with the von Boven principles. Madam Chairperson, advocacy and the recognition of Aboriginal people's human rights is a critical priority for the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. It is for this reason that we hold consultative status with ECOSOC, and through this privilege, we'll continue to access and utilise the United Nations system to challenge all governments to ensure that Indigenous peoples, particularly across the Pacific region, fully enjoy and exercise their human rights. Among the most pressing human rights issues affecting Indigenous peoples throughout the Pacific region, climate change not only poses its own threats, but it's already beginning to exacerbate the extent of human rights violations that Indigenous peoples are already suffering. We as an organisation therefore applaud the Permanent Forum for making climate change the theme for this seventh session. We would, however, urge that you maintain your commitment to this theme and make climate change an ongoing priority in your future work. Further, the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council also urges the Permanent Forum to not only recommend that the newly appointed Special Rapporteur undertake a study into the impact of climate change on the rights of Indigenous peoples, but that in doing so you also recommend that he pay urgent attention to the current and likely threats for Indigenous peoples of the Pacific region. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Norman Ling, New South Wales Aboriginal Land Council. I now call on Barbara Shaw, FIRA Australia. You have the floor, Madam.
Madam Chair, distinguished guests, Indigenous brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Barbara Shaw. I'm a Katage and Narrandal woman from Central Australia. I'm here to speak on behalf of the Indigenous grassroots people of Central Australia on the Australian Government's policy of the intervention. In June of 2007, on the emotive pretext of protecting children from sexual abuse, the previous federal government introduced racially based punitive measures for Aboriginal people living in designated places, prescribed areas. There were no mention of child protection of the 700-page legislation which was rammed through Parliament in a single day. The emergency response legislation suspended the Racial Discrimination Act of 1975, compulsory land acquisition over Aboriginal lands, appointed government business managers to communities, quarantined 50% of every person's welfare payment in prescribed area, legislated the customary law was irrelevant in sentencing, took away community-based jobs programs, CDEP, Community Development Employment Programs, gave police star chambers interrogation powers normally reserved for suspected terrorists, removed the permit system, opening up our lands and removing our powers to protect of sacred sites and mining, The new federal government elected in November 2007 is still implementing and expanding the intervention to other Aboriginal communities and has not committed to reinstating the Racial Discrimination Act 1975, nor is it supporting the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. The Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commissioner released a report in March 2008 damning the Northern Territory National Emergency Response and recommended, among a raft of other changes, and reinstating the RDA. Our people believe that the intent behind the Northern Territory Emergency Response was and is land grab to secure natural resources and minerals in the national interest of the colonial Aboriginal government. We recommend that the United Nations 7th Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues recognise that the Australian anti-government Northern Territory Emergency Response legislation contravenes the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Recognise that the Australian Northern Territory Emergency we recommend that the Australian government implements the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We recommend that the Australian government immediately reinstates the Racial Discrimination Act 1975. We recommend that the Australian government repeals the Intervention Emergency Response Legislation 2007. We recommend that the Australian government implements the 97 recommendations of the Little Children Are Sacred Report 2007. We recommend that the governments intend to extend a formal invitation to the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to report on the Northern Territory Emergency Response Intervention. And finally, we support the statement by Tom Kelmer recommending that the Permanent Forum call on all states to address situations of violence and abuse within Indigenous communities and to do so on a non-discriminatory basis and consistent with human rights standards with the full and effective participation of Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Barbara Shaw. And I now call on you, Siap Flea, from the Dewan Adat Papua. You have the floor, sir.
Dear Madam, Dear Madam Chair, West Papua is home to the world's second largest rainforest. The massive illegal logging of Papua Merbau timber is being fueled by five international flooring companies, which are likely to the acknowledge that they are selling illegal timber. The investigative study by the Bogor-based Talapak and London-based Environment Investigation Agencies reveals that five companies which dominant global sales of wood floor products are heavy consumers of illegal sourced timber, mostly from West Papua. It is necessary to establish a Save Papua's Forest campaign to protect the world heritage and worldwide ocean supply. For Indonesian military and police, controlling West Papua's natural resources is a priority. They are deeply involved in and profiting from illegal mining, illegal logging, and then conversion of forest into hage palm of oil plantation. West Papua has of the highest rate of deforestation in the world. And mining has brought hunger, pollution, and sickness to indigenous Papuan communities. Environmentalist group Greenpeace recently called on the government to protect one of the world's remaining large impact forests in Papua by issuing a logging moratorium. The Jakarta Post, Arya Rukmantara, talked with Greenpeace South Asia Executive Director Amy Half about the importance of protecting West Papua's forest. Papua forests are one of the seven of largest remaining infect forests in the world, besides those in Europe, Africa, North America, Latin America, and Northern Asia. In terms of tropical forests, it is one of the few tropical forest areas left on the planet, along with the Amazon in Brazil and the Congo in Africa. Since the Earth currently has very few intact forests, only 10% previously existing forest area remains, the forests of Papua are becoming very important to the life of the planet. Papuan forest process and enormous biodiversity. The forests are blessed with high diverse and very flora and fauna distinct from Asia and Australia. And the most important thing is that the forest in Papua have support by the leaves of the Papua people for a long time. Before modern development came to Papua, the people had relied on the forest for hundreds of years. We badly need to protect the forest for the sake of the Papuan people. First, the government will make the Papuan people happier. They are unhappy with logging concessions because they are not benefiting from them. They be the brand logging activists such as environment degradation, which has resulted in floods and water shortages and also the plant source of food. If we can protect the forest and provide sustainable community-based logging activities there, the welfare of the local people will improve. Recommendation. We ask to the forum to all the government of Indonesia to immediately implement a moratorium on logging in West Papua. We ask the forum to call the government of Indonesia, World Bank, and multinational companies to respect our right of free, prior, and informed consent. We call the international community to ensure that West Papua people are incorporated in all decision process which involve the lands and peoples of West Papua. It's necessary for the international community to take action to preserve the last remaining rainforest around the world. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Yowab Syafli from the Dewan Adat Papua. I now call on the government of the People's Republic of China to have the floor. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I took the floor in exercising the right to reply, to respond to the statement made by Pacific Regional Caucus this afternoon, by which she mentioned peoples from Taiwan. As you all know, there is only one China in the world, and Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. According to UN Resolution Number 2758, adopted on October 25, 1971, People's Republic of China is the sole legitimate government representing the whole China. The One China policy has long been recognized and followed by the overwhelming majority of UN member states and the UN Secretariat. We regret the fact that the Pacific Regional Forum failed to use the standard UN terminology, which is Taiwan Province of China. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, the delegate of the People's Republic of China. Thank you very much. I'd like now to ask, there are very few minutes left, but I'd like to ask if there's anybody from my colleagues who would like to take the floor very briefly, because we have to also make announcements. Yes, Mr. Hassan Idbal Kasan.
Merci, Madame la Présidente. Je voudrais poser une question au gouvernement australien. وأود أن أتحدث بالعربية. فإننا سمعنا من الشعوب الأصلية هذا المساء ومن حكومتكم كذلك أن هناك تطورات جديدة ونهنئكم على هذه التطورات الإيجابية. شكرا سيدتي الرئيسة. أود أن أشير إلى أنني سمعت من حكومة أستراليا أمس واليوم ومن الشعوب الأصلية أيضا أن هناك تطورات جديدة وكنا قد سمعنا عنها قبل ذلك، فنهنئكم على هذه التطورات الجديدة. لكن أود أن أعرف إن كانت الحكومة الإسترالية الجديدة اعتمدت سياسات جديدة مخالفة للسياسات السابقة، فكنا على علم بأن الحكومة صوتت ضد الإعلان. هل هناك موقف جديد بخصوص إعلان حقوق الشعوب الأصلية؟ ثم هل هناك هيئة مهتمة بتنفيذ إعلان حقوق الشعوب الأصلية وبمشاركة هذه الشعوب؟ السؤال الثاني موجه إلى نيوزيلندا. أشكر السيدة ممثلة نيوزيلندا، فقد تكلمت بلغة الماوري وهذا شيء جيد جدا، لكنني أريد أن أعرف إن كان ممكنا أن تتفضلي سيدتي بتوضيح ما إذا كانت هناك إجراءات عملية لتطوير لغات الشعوب الأصلية في نيوزيلندا. شكرا سيدتي الرئيسة.
Thank you very much, my colleague Hassan Idbal Kasam. We are now, I think we can ask the representatives of the government of Australia and New Zealand. You can have some bilateral talks with them because time is running out and our secretary has to make some announcements. So can you please make the announcements before I make the last words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been asked to make following announcements. The Secretariat of the Convention on Biological Diversity, United Nations Development Programme, United Nations Environment Programme, and the International Union on Conservation of Nature are inviting the delegates for Wednesday, 23 April, from 6 to 8 p.m. to join them at Delegates Dining Room at the UN headquarters. And another announcement is that the mission of Estonia is inviting everybody for the concert of Estonian ethnic music, and that will take place on Wednesday, which is today, 23 April at 6:15. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would like now to first thank our panelists for the presentations that they have made, and we really would like to express our appreciation for taking time out to come here and raise all the issues in the related to the Pacific. Our ambassador has left, but we also would express our appreciation to him. And I'd also like to thank all the ones who have contributed to the discussions today. I'm sure this has really given us a lot more information and substance on the issues of indigenous peoples in the Pacific. I'd like to remind the governments of Australia and New Zealand about the questions that have been raised by my colleague, Hassan Iqbal Qassam, and I hope we'll have time to also discuss those issues. But we have reached now the time limit for this meeting, and I would like to inform all of you that we will continue with some few speakers that were left off from the segment on dialogue with governments, which took place yesterday, and then we will proceed to take up item 4 of our agenda. I'd also like to make an announcement that agenda item 4.1, which is on the implementation of the declaration, will be addressed on Monday. So it's not going to be on Tuesday. It's Monday and Tuesday, okay? So those who have, I think there was a confusion that this is going to be dealt with tomorrow, but that's not going to be dealt with tomorrow. It will be on Monday and Tuesday. So we will take up our agenda item number 4 on our agenda on our meeting tomorrow, and we will meet here at 10 o'clock. The meeting is adjourned.